Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of WrestleNomics Radio. I'm Brandon Thurston, broadcasting live and on demand from Buffalo, New York, where today is Sunday, October 30th, 2021. And today, we can announce that the investigation has concluded. Gullo's camp is saying that some of his dog's teeth are loose. He's had many surgeries that he's had to put his dog through that were very expensive. Gullo says he was just protecting himself under podcast doctrine law against Jesse's advances. But we're not even confirming that an investigation is even taking place or that anything actually happened. But in any event, I've heard that Jesse has been suspended from Cage Match.
Oh, no, that's been rectified.
That's been rectified?
Yeah.
What happened?
I don't really want to, it's not like a major deal. I don't really want to talk about it on air.
You don't want to admit that you're an AEW freakazoid and you're overrating AEW matches.
That is not what happened. I got caught by the words of Cage Match. I got caught up in the crossfire of something larger that was going on.
Okay.
My suspension has been revoked.
Have we co-opted Cage Match now just by having Philip Krakenbaum on the podcast, and now we have special privileges with Cage Match? Is that what's happening here?
I'm not going to lie and say that didn't help rectify the situation, because it absolutely did. Yes.
Okay.
But I can't comment anymore. I respect you for asking that question, Brandon, but I cannot comment anymore.
You can't comment anymore. Fair enough. I have to ask as a journalist, though. Okay, I don't know what we're going to talk about today. I have some slides that we'll go through. It is not Thursday is the earnings call for WWE, but Wednesday. They changed it. They moved it around by half a day. It was going to be Thursday afternoon, but they changed it to Wednesday morning. John Pollock is very upset about this. He doesn't like it when it's that late in the day. In any case, we're going to do a talk. John and I will do a talk on Thursday that will be on the Post Network, and the audio will also be in your normal WrestleNomics Radio feed. So, mass distribution for the post wrestling / WrestleNomics talk on the WQ3 earnings call. But first, I guess, Green Bay Packers, Buffalo Bills, later tonight. Yep. Chris Gullo, live correspondent in attendance.
Yep, for Halloween Eve game, Sunday Night Football. It's going to be pretty exciting. I'm going as the ultimate heel, an NFL referee. So
Green Bay Packers on a 3-game losing streak.
Yep.
Aaron Rodgers, I think he has done his research for this game. I think he is prepared. But he's going against Josh Allen, who is running a lot, hurdling a lot, and I don't know if anything can really stop the Buffalo Bills right now.
Yeah, Bills victory tonight for sure.
Well, they're 11.5-point favorites, which might be a record for how Aaron Rodgers' career as being like the biggest underdog he's been as far as from a point spread standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Do the Patriots play today?
Patriots play against the New York Jets at 1 p.m.
Oh. The Jets are looking pretty good, right?
Bills have this is a game. I said this on the NFL Intelligentsia on Wednesday, but this is a game Jets fans have been looking forward to for about 20 years.
20 years.
Their chance to finally just evaporate the Patriots in the game.
Have the Jets not beaten the Patriots in years and years?
They have, and including a playoff win about 10 years ago. But by and large, the story has been the Patriots have beaten up the Jets for the past 20 years, ever since Bill Belichick resigned from coaching the Jets and became the Patriots coach.
And the Patriots do have a starting quarterback. Do they have one starting quarterback? Do they have two starting quarterbacks, one and 1A? Or what exactly is the what do you call it, the depth chart?
I'm not sure what they're going to do today. I know Mac Jones is going to start the game, but if he doesn't look too good, I think Bailey Zappe could come back in.
Okay. Start Zappe. They should start Zappe for the Patriots talk, and if the Jets beat the Patriots, it'd be like when the Bills beat the Patriots for that playoff game.
Bills have already gotten their revenge.
Yeah.
On the Patriots. The Dolphins have beaten the Patriots regularly over the last few years. It's the Jets who are the ones who are last in line, waiting to bury the knife 6 inches deep into the Patriots. Yeah.
And it's Bills Jets next Sunday, so.
Is it? Yeah. Is that at home for the Bills or away?
No, that's away.
That's away.
Presumably, if the Jets win this game, they could beat the Jets. If they beat the Bills next week, they'd be in first place, which would be a truly stunning development for, I think, everyone in the AFC East.
Yes. Okay. If you want to ask questions and have us talk about something other than NFL, you can send in a super chat at your leisure if you're watching live. So this is my EPS. This is my earnings per share ratio estimate. 28 cents, which is way lower than the consensus. Than the rest of the analysts, they think it's going to be 49 cents. 49 cents earnings per share. I think it's going to be 28. I can't figure out how they're getting to 49. To be clear, I don't really have their big reports. We're still saving up for a Bloomberg terminal here at WrestleNomics, so I'm not sure exactly what their models are telling them. Can anyone tell me what an earnings per share ratio is?
I assume it's how much each share is basically worth. But how much earning power each individual share has.
It's basically profitability divided by the number of shares that there are. For some reason, that this is how things are measured on the stock market. It's an impression of profitability adjusted for the dilution of the stock, is my understanding. Think about it as an impression of profitability, though. Revenue, I'm expecting almost $300 million in revenue, $294 million in revenue for Q3. Again, we're talking only about Q3, which is the period of July 1st to September 30th. So as always, they report about 1 month after the period has ended. Consensus is a little bit lower by $10 million, 284. I'm at 209. It's higher revenue. I'm higher on the top line revenue, and they're a little bit higher on profitability. I am considering that in Q3, we always get this production incentives or something like that that they got last year. I am counting like $8 million for that. So I'm taking that into consideration. I don't know that I expect this to be an especially eventful earnings call. I do expect lots of talk, though, about Easter eggs. I almost wonder, too, if the part of the reason for changing the date, which they did say had to do with the Saudi Arabia event, which is happening this coming, I believe, Saturday. They did say that the Saudi Arabia event was part of the reason or the reason why they moved the date of the earnings call. I wonder if they decided that they were going to have more involvement from Paul Levesque than they originally planned when they first announced the date. In any case, I do expect him to participate based on that. That'd be my guess. And I expect lots of talk about Easter eggs and some talk about Bray Wyatt as it relates to those Easter eggs. And I know that's something that he's been saying to other people. And he has said publicly as well about how WWE is engaging with their fans through Easter eggs and, you know, all these things that they did with Bray Wyatt and the QR codes.
Do you think of that nature. With the Easter eggs and the barcodes and kind of the analysts' analysis of videos and things like that are being shown, do you think part of the motivation to include a lot of those is to also help with things like social media impressions and engagement with different WWE platforms through social media?
What could be more important than social media? Absolutely. But seriously, yes. Yeah, definitely.
I saw, I want to say it was the Twitter account WrestleOps. They had tweeted something, and I don't know where they got this figure. I don't know if it had been reported somewhere else or WWE had released it publicly, but they said that...
counted it up themselves, but yeah.
Well, they said that the Roman Reigns, Usos, Sami Zayn segment from SmackDown on Friday had achieved over 12 million impressions on social media across all platforms. So I assume that figure has to come from WWE, but I thought it was interesting that it was being presented on a third party site as a statistic, and what does the impressions mean? I thought it was interesting. I don't know if WWE is releasing that information privately or publicly to different outlets, but I thought it was notable that it was kind of being talked about on social media.
Yeah, I've got it at 1.3 million. This is as of 10 a.m. today, which is, you know, well above anything else in SmackDown. I was doing some stuff on Python this morning that I didn't complete to try to compare it to the trajectory of other YouTube videos this year, but didn't quite get to it. But this is pretty strong. I mean, and anything over a million is exceptional. And it being over a million, we're about 36 hours in, is pretty good. I wouldn't call this like extreme and total. I mean, usually we get one or so clip a week, per Raw and SmackDown that hits a million, but this is on the higher end, sure.
Is it notable that it's very much, it's almost double the, it's more than, it's about double the views of
that
the
happens,
next
though.
Fierce one. Next, double the views of the Bray Wyatt video.
On the same show.
Right.
Right. Proof Bray Wyatt's not a draw.
No, validation. I just think it's interesting.
Yeah. And anything else to expect from this earnings call? Not that I can really think of. We'll see what
happens. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how, if there are questions fielded about Vince McMahon, if there are questions there about the investigation, on Vince McMahon, and even if there's not, how there won't be. Is this the first earnings call without Vince McMahon, or did they do the Q2 one without him?
The last one they had, that was in August. So yes, this will be the second one. There was one question kind of about Vince. Brandon Ross from Lightshed asked something that in a roundabout way was about, well, are you going to sell the company because Vince is gone now, or do you still see this as a family company that you want to keep indefinitely? And Stephanie in my reading gave a non-answer. That was the closest we got to anything related to Vince.
I'm interested to see what Nick Khan's going to talk about. Sometimes he kind of breaks a little news. Sometimes, you know, he discusses recent TV rights deal, which I don't think there's really been a big sports media rights deal in the last few months. But I'm interested to see.
We're waiting on Big Ten, right?
No, the Big Ten got that big deal. We're waiting on the Pac-12, which their conference is in limbo right now. I'm very intrigued to see if he'll talk about next day air rights at all. Because he's brought it up before, and now we're in that limbo period where Hulu keeps, you know, keeping the content up, says it expires, but takes the expiration tag off, then puts the expiration tag on again. And
all the expiration tags are gone as of last I looked. I can look right now, too. But I don't think he'll bring it up himself. Maybe someone will ask again. Someone asked last time. Eric Handler asked. I don't think we're going to learn anything, probably. Yeah. I don't know. We could.
It will be somewhat interesting. It's just we're now reviewing a full quarter of non-Vince programming and to see kind of how if the media calls or the investors calls take on any type of different format or pattern without Vince involved at all. Vince had been kind of not being involved, had not been very directly involved in the investor calls.
Vince
even
barely
when
spoke
he was still there.
In his last years as right. CEO of this company.
So it's probably not going to be that different. So it's probably not going to be that different. It's probably mainly going to just be Nick Khan talking. But it'll be interesting to see maybe if the format is different, if some of the things that Stephanie or Triple H might talk about would be maybe different, things that Vince maybe would have said in the past. I don't know. It doesn't seem like
Nick to talk, as he always does. He'll have an opening statement. I expect Stephanie to have an opening statement. I expect Frank Riddick to have a boring accounting talk, but one that he has to have. Will Paul Levesque have a similar opening statement? I think is a question. Mm-hmm. Maybe he will.
So this morning it's being reported that Big 12. So the Big 12 has reached a new TV rights deal.
Big 12.
Yeah, and that's a conference that lost Texas and Oklahoma.
Whoa! There's a Big 10, there's a Pac-12, and there's a Big 12.
Yes.
Vince would never stand for this. This is confusing.
No,
guess how many teams are in the Big Ten?
Not ten.
I don't know the count exactly, but there was, I think recently there was, the Big Ten had 12 teams and the Big 12 had 10 teams.
So it looks like they've reached a deal with ESPN and Fox, $380 million per year, an increase of 73% from its current deal. And this is a conference that lost its two most popular colleges. That is
Big 12.
Yes.
Is this like the number three most prestigious college football league?
No, not at all. I would say it's Big Ten. It's Big Ten and SEC battling each other for one and two, and then probably ACC.
ACC.
Yeah. For football, I think it's probably the Big 12.
You think it's – but once again, we're taking Texas and Oklahoma out of it. I mean, I guess you still got
Texas. Yeah. You have Texas – well, you have Oklahoma State, Kansas. Kansas State. Yeah. Texas Christian. Yeah, maybe it's ACC. I don't know. ACC is always to me a basketball conference, but I guess they have Clemson.
I do know ACC have Clemson, right? And they have North Carolina University and Duke, and that those
is Florida State, which is the big one. Florida for football. Yeah,
Clemson and Florida State would be
Miami.
The big two.
They have Miami as well.
Yeah, it's hard for me to know. Like, I just think about what teams have been good, but that's not exactly always an indicator. It's a lot of it is based on prestige and alumni and global fan base. But what most people seem to think in the college world is that we're going to be headed towards, maybe the TV contracts keep it together for a long enough time, but we're going to be headed towards some sort of two big conferences essentially battling it out. That's why the Big Ten has already dipped their toe into acquiring schools like USC and UCLA to kind of raid the Pac-12 of their biggest schools. And the SEC will probably continue to raid the Big 12 for their schools.
Yeah. And if the SEC starts raiding the ACC, then it's on, which they possibly could be. Miami, Florida State, that makes sense for the SEC. So is Clemson.
Well, as we learned with the USC acquisitions, geography means nothing. So anyone is on the table. But it all comes down. Now, are these deals, Gullo, do you know if they're just for football or are they for all sports? Is there a college basketball component or are those social?
I think the football and the basketball come together.
Yes. I think that there is a basketball component to it, too. There's probably like sub deals with basketball. But yeah, like for years, like I know because Fox has put all their chips in. Well, they used to on Pac-12 football and basketball. So and that was always and
CBS had SEC basketball and baseball and football as well.
I think technically this would be like all sports, but obviously, you know, they're not really like maybe the subsidiary Fox channels and ESPN, you know, plus is showing,
you know, right. The football is what's the most football is the most valuable. But if there's a sport that has any other monetary value to these colleges, it would be college basketball. And the ACC would be the college basketball
conference. Yes. Yeah, they are. Sure. They are the number one conference in college basketball for sure.
Okay.
All right. Continue.
Yeah, I'll continue monitoring, and now we have Nick Conca talk about this. Now we have news Nick Conca talk about. It's like, yeah,
I wouldn't be surprised if he talks about that. So, something else we might learn about on Wednesday morning is some impression of what the paid attendance was for Clash of the Castle because of how they do their key performance indicator slides, which is, let's see if I can pull them up quickly. Let's see here. They do key performance indicators. And if I remove this, right? I'll stop screen and then restart this. And we'll put the investor relations page on the screen for people watching on YouTube. If I go to the key performance indicator slides, which are no longer updating. Oh, I see. Let's open a new tab. So if we go here, this is as of the last update for Q2, they're doing Q3 this week. And we have this international side of attendance that they give us. So that's going to have one event in Q3. There were no other international events, unless I'm totally missing something. I'm pretty sure there's only one international event in this entire quarter, and that was Clash of the Castle. So we'll get an average for the international section of their attendance, and that should be one event. So we might get an impression. And this is always my belief strongly is that this is always paid attendance. Yes, the WrestleMania thing that they put in the press release and sometimes that they even mention in other things that are nearer to investor relations. Yeah, that might be fictitious. But this is real attendance here. This is reflecting real paid ticket sales. So I think we'll get an impression of that. I think I'm baking in like 45,000 paid because I think actually Nikon said that they had 45,000 paid in excess of that on the previous call. So we'll get some impression of how many tickets it sold. And then there's a breakdown. There's a totally separate line of reporting that they do for international ticket sales too, which should give us a pretty clear idea of what the gate was as well as the average ticket price. So we'll see how that goes. I think they will break down merch. No, they'll do domestic merch per capita, but anyway, That's what to expect there. The stock price, W shares, have been on the rise as it gets closer and closer to $70 or to $80 per share. We are now, as of the close of the market Friday, at $78.72. W is worth just under $6 billion in market capitalization. Vince McMahon has gained on paper his market value He's gained like $367 million on paper in unrealized equity. I tweeted it. The news sites picked it up. They still owe me a coffee that they have not given me yet. That did deter quote tweets, though. That would have been quote tweeted, but I said, you owe me a coffee if you quote tweet this, and the IWC is afraid to owe me a coffee, clearly. But this is my stock price target, which is based on forward-looking profitability, forward-looking EBITDA, is $76. We're now over that declared stock price target that we put out on September 21st, when the stock was only $67. Remember those days when W stock was only $67? I do. And now it's worth $78. So if you listened to WrestleNomics, not saying that you should, this is not financial advice, nor should it be construed as such. Don't sue me. But if you bought W stock back in September when it was worth $67, you are now considerably more wealthy because the stock is worth a lot more. And we also back in around WrestleMania time said $62.94, $63. That's a little undervalued. Well, it's way above that. Are we getting to the point where this stock is overvalued? I wouldn't quite say that. It's plausible that, you know, there's a lot of leeway here, I think, for speculating about what their next media rights deal is worth. Now, if this stock gets up to like $100 and stuff like that, then you may see WrestleNomics start to lament the insanity of the stock market, as has happened in previous rounds. And I want to call this out specifically. If we look back to the speculation, the run-up to the 2014 TV deal, there was this huge speculation bump, and then the stock collapsed. It was actually getting near $30, and then the stock collapsed as W had a disappointing TV deal back in 2014. This is the infamous comment from Vince where he says, you can put me in a hammer lock if we don't at least double our TV rights value. He thought that they could triple their TV rights value. He told, I believe it was Mike Hickey, that he could put him in a hammer lock if they didn't reach that multiple. They got a 1.7 multiple, so they didn't even double it. I don't think Vince McMahon has delivered on that hammerlock, but nonetheless, I think the W Network got in the way in the sense of Comcast is benefits from W pay-per-view sales, I believe. And I believe part of the story is that W undercutting its own pay-per-view business maybe made Comcast / NBC Universal a little bit less enthusiastic about renewing W at a big rate. This is before Fox gets involved. That happens in 2018. There's a big run-up as W makes its new TV deal. It made the new TV deal in spring of 2018. So just after this huge run-up really starts to happen, there's a little bit of spike here, and it goes right back up to nearly $100, and it totally collapses back to $40. I guess what I'm saying here is I would be watching to see if a similar ridiculous valuation of this stock price is coming. There was a lot of last time speculation around international value too. What can they get in India? That'll be coming up too, I would think. I think that's a 5-year deal that started in 2020. So that may be coming up for renegotiation shortly after the US deal. The UK deal lost value in the last round. What's happening there with BT Sport, Channel 5? I don't know if there's more value to gain in the UK. There might be marginal. There might be some incremental value to gain in India still. But a big open question with lots of possibilities I see still with the US deal. 1.5x is a good base case. Is it going to be less than 1.5x? I would be surprised, and that would be disappointing, and that would hurt the stock. Could it be a lot more? Maybe. Could see Amazon getting involved and taking SmackDown. That seems very realistic to me. And if that's the case, I could see this going well over 1.5x.
I mean, very big. I mean, we see the Big 12 is getting $380 million a season, and that's a conference that's decreasing in popularity. So,
What's that as a multiple over what their incumbent deal is, average annual value?
So it was a 78% increase of what they previously had, which was a 2.6 billion deal over, it looks like,
78% increase. Yeah. So 1.8x, right?
Yeah.
That's healthy. especially for probably a deal that is probably already pretty high, right?
Yeah. Now that's two networks chipping in, which could be obviously very similar with WWE with SmackDown and Raw. So
I would expect SmackDown and Raw to stay separated. I don't buy that Comcast is going to buy this company. I don't really buy that anybody's going to buy it anytime soon. Endeavor does seem like the most sensible option. I don't think a big media company like Comcast wants anything to do with wrestling. It's too lowbrow. So anyway, moving on. What else have we got? Should we do the Hall of Fame? This could be a 3-hour conversation on its own.
It could. I've already recorded 2.5 hours of audio on the Hall of Fame this week. What are your thoughts? You want me to do my ballot right now, live on air?
If you want
to. Sure. My unofficial ballot.
This is Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, by the way.
Yes. So my unofficial ballot right now is in the historical performers era category, Johnny Rougeau, and that's it.
Where's Johnny
Rougeau? Just Johnny Rougeau.
There he is. I don't know who Johnny Rougeau is. Is that Jacques Rougeau's father?
It's either his father. I think it's his uncle. Okay. But Johnny Rougeau was a huge star in Montreal from late 1950s into the 1970s. And was also a star in the Northeast to a degree. His career is probably underrepresented in most kind of history books and TV documentaries and things like that, because it was a little bit longer ago than most people go back with their history, which is mostly to the 70s and 80s. He was in a non-English speaking promotion, which would be promotions in Montreal, and his tapes were not purchased by WWE, so his video of the video library is much more difficult to find. But I think if you look at his drawing record and his star power over a long period of time, he stands out.
What decades would this be?
I would say his peak would be the 1960s, but he was definitely a star, I think, into the 70s. But, you know, they were running some successful stadium shows at the Montreal Expos baseball stadium later in his career. But, you know, was consistently drawing between 10 to 20,000 people for shows for decades. Wrestled a ton of big names over that span, gotten a very notable promotional war with another promotion in Montreal. Pat LaParade, I might be pronouncing his name wrong, but he wrote a very good article going way into the history and the drawing record. It's on the Observer site. That was very convincing to me. I didn't honestly know that much about him, but if you do the research on all these guys, I don't like voting for the tag teams. I should add that. I'm kind of ignoring them this year. I think it's stupid. I think the way Dave has done it is really stupid.
So for people who don't know, there's a new rule. New rules in this system here. There are now no more tag team erasure. Their tag teams are now being considered. There have always been tag teams on the ballot. You know, Rock and Roll Express got in recent years. Midnight Express, I believe, got in. You know, Tully Blanchard and Arn Anderson as a tag team have been on this ballot for years. But Dave is adding candidates where one of the members of the tag team is already a Hall of Famer, but the other member is not a Hall of Famer. For example, Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee, Akira Tawe and Toshiaki Kawada, Manami Toyota and Toshio Yamada, Antonio Inoki and Seiji Sakaguchi, Ricky Choshu and Animal Hamaguchi. This has never been done before.
Yeah, Bulldog's not in, but Dynamite is, right? Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. I think the Von Erichs being on as a trio is a first, right?
No. The Freebirds are in.
I mean the Von Erichs themselves.
Yes.
The Rockers are on the ballot in the historical category for the first time. Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty.
Oh, some of these are wrong. Some of these are wrong, I think.
I copied and pasted this from the email he sent me.
Yeah, well, the email he got wrong. Like, the Von Erichs are historical. No, he's admitted this. Like, the Von Erichs are... So the cutoff for historical and modern is 30 years ago. So the cutoff is 1992.
So right, if the Rockers are in the historical, the Von Erichs should certainly...
If you stopped being a main event act before 1992, you should be in the historical category. If you were a main event act after 1992, you were in the modern category. the Von Erichs obviously stopped being main event acts well before 1992.
What if you're never a main event act?
In the historical performance. I would say that most of these acts are.
There's definitely some acts here.
It's basically your when did you kind of stop at your prime? When did your prime start to decline? Because some of these guys did wrestle after 1992.
And everybody's getting extra votes if they want them, only for this year because of the addition of all these extra tag teams.
You can vote in up to 8 names per category instead of 5, although that's only for the historical performers category. It's not for modern or Japan or Mexico or any other categories.
While we're talking about the system, just briefly, let me add in here. How many people actually vote in this thing? It's been more this year. So last year it's in the biggest category that people do vote in the modern U.S. and Canada, over 450 people voted, and this has increased over the years. I did look up like are there like a lot of people voting relative to like say the Baseball Hall of Fame, which this Hall of Fame is so often compared to. Now it's on par, I would say, with the Baseball Hall of Fame. So it's not like,
certainly more than like the Football Hall of Fame, which only has a very limited number of voters.
Does it? Just thoughts on the tag teams, and is that a good decision or not?
I think I don't like. I'm kind of the minority. I think a lot of people seem to have enjoyed it, but I think it just complicates the ballot in unnecessary fashion because the reality is that most of these guys, the reason one guy is in the Hall of Fame and one partner is not is because one partner is a significantly bigger star than the other. And so it's almost like in a lot of cases, it's like these guys that are not Hall of Famers sponging off of guys that are Hall of Famers and sponging off of their drawing power to then make an argument for themselves. A perfect example is Argentina Roca and Miguel Perez. So if you look at them as a tag team, there's an argument that they're the best drawing tag team of all time. They drew huge houses consistently throughout the 1950s, a lot of it at Madison Square Garden, setting gate records at Madison Square Garden. Huge, huge act. But it's mostly because Argentina Roca was a massive star during that time period and is one of the 5 or 6 biggest individual drawing cards in the history of American wrestling. And so the fact that Miguel Perez is his tag team partner is like, it's really just Argentina Roca. And like, not to say Perez didn't add anything to the act or anything like that, but it's hard for me to be like, Miguel Perez now needs to get in the Hall of Fame because he was in a tag team with Argentina Roca. To use another example, Akira Taue and Toshiaki Kawada, the Holy Demon Army.
Brace for Akira Taue disrespect. It's incoming.
It is incoming. So Taue has been on the ballot as an individual for years. And so when he was on the ballot as an individual,
he just fell off, right?
I don't know if he fell off or he's now just being converted into this tag team, because that's happened with other guys too that have been on the ballot. So he's in this tag team now. So when he was on the ballot as individual and failed to get in, when he was being evaluated as an individual, you were supposed to take into consideration the entire breadth of his career. So all of his singles matches and all of his tag team matches. And so for voters, they saw Akira Taue's career, which considered his run as part of the Holy Demon Army as a crucial part of it. And they said, I don't really think he should be in. And so he never got in. Now he's being converted to just as a tag team, where you're supposed to evaluate his career just as a tag team wrestler. In a lot of cases, that makes him have a stronger case because the Holy Demon Army is one of the biggest drawing tag teams of all time. And for their greatest draws was very high and the match quality was very, very high. But to me, if Taue wasn't good enough before when we were encompassing his entire career, why would he be good enough now when we're just looking at his tag team run? We're looking at less of his career and saying he's more likely to get in. And the only reason for that is because he was tag team partners with Toshiaki Kawada, who is a Hall of Famer, who is an amazing professional wrestler, and was a huge drawing card, and that whole act in All Japan Pro Wrestling really took off. But if you just take Taue away from Kawada, he doesn't stand up to Hall of Fame quality. And I think it's ridiculous for us to now have basically a referendum on whether Taue should get in or not through this tag team prism. I think we figured out if Taue should be in the Hall of Fame. He didn't when he was on as a singles. Why are we looking at just his tag team record now and making that, because that's a smaller sample size where he achieved more? and had like a higher percentage of success than he did as a singles act. We're now looking at that and saying, oh, this is a no-brainer Hall of Fame pick because they're one of the best tag teams of all time. It's like they're one of the best tag teams of all time because Toshiaki Kawada is great. And not to say that Taui's like a stiff, but he's not a Hall of Fame quality performer. And I don't like this being used to kind of goose those guys into the Hall of Fame.
I'm tempted to say, thoughts, Golo. I feel like it's kind of my initial reaction to this rule is it's kind of inflating the Hall of Fame and putting a lot of people in who are giving the chance to be in or giving candidacy to people who I don't know, I guess we kind of the voters have kind of decided are not Hall of Famers. Or in Japan in particular, there isn't this unit tag team concept like there is in the United States, say the Rock and Roll Express, the Midnight Express, where that's their identity as a brand, let's say. Whereas Inoki and Sakaguchi, they were very much individuals, right? And in Japan in particular, there's more of a tradition of a lot of tag teams, which leads to big stars having frequent tag partners. And in All Japan in the '90s in particular, treating the tag title like a main event title, where people who fought for the Triple Crown and major singles matches also competed for the tag title, such as Kawada and Taue. I totally get nominating the Steiner brothers, maybe the Von Erichs, even as a trio, the Freebirds and things like that. Considering the Hardy Boys, cause they're somebody who really had an identity as a tag team. It's straining the borders of how we define candidates, I think.
To use an example, and I haven't researched this, so I might be incorrect, but I feel pretty confident in saying, like, if you were to look at, like, Hulk Hogan and Brutus Beefcake, their drawing records when they were, like, a tag team, I'm sure were probably really good. I'm sure if you looked at, like, them, they probably sold out shows in, like, could be compared to like other main event acts of that time period and be successful draws, but no one would ever really, you wouldn't really consider that as like a Hall of Fame tag team, because I think most people would acknowledge that the reason that tag team was over was because Hulk Hogan's like this enormous star and Hulk Hogan's really over and Brutus Beefcake's like kind of lucky to be on the team with him.
But Hulk, I think Hogan's bags would have never gotten there if not for Brutus.
And I think that's like, To use an example I think more people are familiar with, that's what I look at when I see like Rocca and Perez, because I'm listening to Dave and he's like, well, Rocca and Perez, they've got to be in because they're this great tag team act. And it's like Argentina Rocca is this great individual drawing card and his tag team partner, you know, was able to get into a lot of main events because he was tagging with them. I don't understand why we need to now make sure Miguel Perez is in the Hall of Fame or that this tag team is recognized in the Hall of Fame. Those main events and those big houses are all recognized in Argentina Rocca's induction in 1996. So like, I feel like we don't need to recognize like the guy, the secondary members of these tag teams.
So we could spend hours going through this whole thing, but let's focus on maybe some high interest highlights. What do you want to say, Gal?
I just have a real quick question. When you guys evaluate this, do you take in maybe the non-wrestling part? So, like, for example, Bill Dundee's now in this tag team because he hasn't got in as an individual, but Bill Dundee was also a pretty successful booker for Mid-South. Like, does that take in, like, being a booker and an in-ring talent altogether? Do you guys
evaluate that? Yes. I think that's a big reason why Shima is on this ballot as a trainer. Yeah. Yes. Do you agree?
Wrestlers are supposed to be evaluated. There's three criteria to be evaluated.
But nobody's going to be in as a wrestler and as a non-wrestler. Nobody is, right?
No. They're in.
Nobody's a double Hall of Famer here.
There are double Hall of Famers, but they're recognized for different. They're recognized in different ways. I can't
like is a lot of them is a wrestler and a promoter.
Right. So a lot of these people were original inductees in the class of 1996. So that's where there's no voting process. Dave is just putting in a massive wave of like obvious people to get into the Hall of Fame. And a lot of those people are recognized for being in the Hall of Fame, both as professional wrestlers and as promoters. Giant Baba, Vern Gagne, Bill Watts, Inoki.
Is the story that like this is a Hall of Fame that was invented on a plane ride back from Japan or something?
I don't know. I don't know when Dave invented it. It sounds right, but it's a but so there are people in as both. I think so. There's three criteria for wrestlers to be voted in. They can be outstanding in one of the criteria and bad at the others and get in. They can be just, you know, above average in all three criteria and get in and not being but there's supposed to be three criteria you use to evaluate. The first is drawing power. The second is excelling in the one's field of professional wrestling, which are considered the performance criteria. So people usually related to in-ring work, but is also supposed to be considered people who may have been excellent promos, things like that. Were you actually good at professional wrestling as an art form? And then the last one is historical significance. And so a lot of times with wrestlers like Shima, as an example, you can say, okay, this is his in-ring ability. This was his performance level. This was his drawing record. And then what is the historical significance? Is it him being a trainer, him being a booker? That kind of aspect also plays into it. So you are supposed to evaluate all of those contributions to pro wrestling in the candidacy. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's just call out a few big names on the ballot then. Roman Reigns is back on the ballot. Is Roman Reigns a Hall of Famer as his career stands in 2022?
I talked about this on a podcast I did. I'll plug it at the end this week. Mm-hmm. I'm not voting for Roman Reigns, but it asks a question about if Roman Reigns is not in the Hall of Fame, is the Hall of Fame an absurd concept? Because Reigns, from a kayfabe standpoint, is a Hall of Famer. He's main evented WrestleMania multiple times. He's held world titles for very long periods of time. He's probably been the most famous active wrestler in the world for a period of time. Does he meet any of the three criteria would be subject to debate. I'm saying no at the moment, but he's definitely a fascinating candidate. We talked about him a lot earlier this week, and I think eventually I will vote for him just because it will become absurd that he's not in, but I'm not ready to yet.
If I guess it's like if whatever this era is, maybe you started like when the network launched in 2014. If anybody from this era from WWE is going to be a Hall of Famer, it's going to be Reigns, right? If Reigns is not a Hall of Famer, then nobody from this era is. To be clear, Cena's give people some background. So Cena's already in. Lesnar's already in. Like who else? Is such so a Brian, top star.
Bryan Danielson is in. AJ Styles is in. CM Punk might get in this year. I don't know.
Randy Orton, but he's technically a different era before too.
So Randy Orton's like, not in.
Yeah, he's on the ballot.
He's
not this
in,
year.
So yeah, he's on the ballot. Yeah. So I mean, I assume he would be in eventually.
Yeah, and like I voted for Danielson and I voted for AJ Styles, and part of their case is
in ring work, right?
And non WWE work. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I think we talk about Reigns in sort of in similar ways to CM Punk, who's also on the ballot, who I have voted for. I've not voted for Reigns, but I feel similar to Jesse in that I will probably vote for him eventually. I don't know if I'll vote for him this year. I'll have to think about it. I haven't decided who I'm voting for, but I think Punk is another very interesting one. Again, I voted for him. I have all my vote records back here. I voted for Punk multiple years in the past. I voted for him last year. I voted for him in 2019. I voted for him in 2017. So I voted for him three times. As a draw, his case has been strengthened. I went on a rant last week on WrestleNomics Radio about look at all these things he did. He popped the biggest pay-per-view that AEW's ever done. All their pay-per-views with him have been bigger than any of the pay-per-views without him. $1 million gates seems to be a quarter hour positive contributor. Okay. But this in practice, I think this Hall of Fame, like any voting system, even though we've got, you know, a select number of voters here who are reporters, I would be curious what the breakdown is as far as people who are actually returning ballots in terms of the percentage of people who are just, you know, writers, reporters, and the people who have actually worked in the business, wrestlers and so forth. But anyway, regardless of that, what happened after All Out paints him in a bad light, I think I would say generally to most people. And does that hurt his candidacy? In practice, probably. And I think that's probably going to outweigh, in the voter's perspective, any positive contribution to his getting in that his actual drawing performance which has been strengthened substantially in the last year. So anyway, I think he's no more likely this year to get in, although I'll probably vote for him again, despite the fight that he was involved in.
I think he's more likely to get in this year than last year because of the drawing record that he displayed throughout for most of 2022.
But is this a Shawn Michaels thing where, like, people wouldn't put Shawn Michaels in for years because, you know, pre the comeback, he was such, you know,
his reputation was poor.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to me, I was actually, so I didn't vote for him last year. And I said, you know what? I probably think he should be in, but I'm going to wait a year because I knew he was probably going to win the title sometime in 2022. Let's see if his drawing power holds up and let's see if he puts a little bit more of a track record down as a draw outside of just kind of his immediate return, which is what we were talking about this time last year. And I thought he had done that. And around halfway point of this year, I was like, Jesse, you did it right. You took time. You didn't vote for CM Punk. And now look at the drawing record he's put up. You can confidently put his name down in 2022. So you handled this very well. And then I looked at, and then the All Out thing happened. And now I'm like, well, now it's kind of like a mystery. I'd like to see what the long-term ramifications from a business perspective are from the All Out press conference and of CM Punk quitting and seeing how that factors into his Hall of Fame case. And if business goes down without CM Punk, which it kind of has, is that, do we look at that and saying as more evidence that CM Punk as an individual was a big drawing card and therefore it helps his case? Or can you say CM Punk is unprofessional and this is a negative thing that he did and that should hurt his case? I think there's no rush to put him in, so I'm going to hold off again for another year. But if he got in, I would totally understand the drawing case for it. I think it's been established.
Mm-hmm. I guess, yeah. I mean, I will probably vote for him just because I voted for him in the past. I think his case has been strengthened. I think he was unprofessional and a detriment to his company after the press conference. But I don't feel like that's something that will dissuade me outright from voting for him again.
The only modern candidate I feel like I'm going to vote for this year is Paul Orndorff.
Who have I voted for? I only voted for CM Punk in that category last year.
It's both the historical and the modern U.S. candidates don't have a ton of candidates that I feel like I have to vote for.
We talked about Cowboy Bob Ellis, Jesse. You said you were going to vote for him, right? Because of how big of a draw he was. Cowboy Bob Ellis. Yeah, didn't we talk about that? Oh, thought we talked about that last week on here. Yeah, well, Cowboy Bob Ellis was a huge draw.
Yeah,
and I feel like somebody should vote for him in the historical candidate.
He was a big babyface act for a long time. I think, you know, the historical act. So my policy in historical acts, generally speaking, is I am a recent voter of this ballot. I'm a recent voter for this. A lot of these guys have been, their candidacy has been debated for decades. I don't really feel like there's not that many guys out there that I feel like have to actually get in. We're all talking about very fringe and borderline cases for these guys because they have been there. And for the most part, their cases have been combed over by people who are more familiar with that time period than me, people that were contemporaries of these names. And I don't want to be like the baseball veterans committee and just start putting in like the biggest borderline candidates possible and kind of lowering the standard of the Hall of Fame. I'm a small Hall of Fame person. I'd like to have a more limited, more select group than maybe other voters. And I just see all of these guys for the most part as being talent that's on the border. And I don't really feel like one of the reasons I'm high on Johnny Rougeau is because I feel like he hasn't been given a fair shake because of, I think he's a little bit older of a candidate. And I don't think the fact that he was in a non-English speaking promotion and that there's not a lot of videotape of him available makes him like a less known candidate than someone like, Ole Anderson or Rocky Johnson or Black Jack Mulligan or Harley Race and Larry Henning, and these guys who have been, I think they're available. Sergeant Slaughter, like these guys, I don't think like Sergeant Slaughter to me is not, and Junkyard Dog are two like very famous names. I don't think those guys are getting like shafted historically for what they've done. I think their accomplishments are very well known, but they haven't been determined good enough to get in. I don't really see a lot of evidence to kind of change that. I really need to be convinced that someone is being really overlooked to vote for them, I think, if they're in the historical candidacy.
I have voted for JYD in the past. I did not put him on my ballot last year. Somebody I will most likely vote for, who I did vote for last year, is Tomohiro Ishii. I will probably vote for Naito eventually. I don't know if I'll vote for him this year.
You should vote for Naito over Ishii.
It's age, though. I voted for Okada, despite him being however old he was, 34, 35, I guess 35 last year, because he has to be 35, because he was such an obvious candidate. Naito is not a super obvious candidate to me, and I think it's absurd that we have to vote on people who are under 40, much less under 45. Ishii is like, how old is Ishii now? Ishii's like in his late 40s now. Yeah. Not nearly the draw.
I think he's 45.
Okay, but Ishii not nearly the star that Naito is. But I think he's such an obvious, outstanding performer. One of maybe arguably the greatest wrestler of his era. That he's got to go in. And I think his style itself is influential. A style that people associate with matches in the G1 Climax in this era, I think, is especially exemplified by him.
He'll be 47 in December.
Okay. So he's 46. I think if we're talking Japan, I think Naito is the most obvious candidate on this ballot, not counting some of the non-wrestlers who I think are more obvious, but I think Naito has the most obvious clear-cut slam dunk case. I think he's significantly big enough draw. In a lot of cases, for some of the years in New Japan, he was the biggest draw in the company ahead of Tanahashi and Okada. I don't know if that's translated over to the Western market as much, but in Japan, he's been hugely successful, both as a merchandise draw and as a attendance draw. And I think he's been really underrated as a worker. I think I personally enjoy Tetsuya Naito as a worker more than Tomohiro Ishii. I did this exercise with Adam Berger on Thursday. I was saying, I think Ishii is a great in-ring worker, and I'm willing to actually put Ishii on my ballot. But I was going over this thing. I was like, I think Ishii's like the eighth best worker from his era of New Japan. Like, so the concept of him being like this outstanding above everyone else worker, which is what his candidacy is going to have to hinge on, I disagree with. But
if Naito and Reigns seem comparable to me in some ways, like if Naito's in, if you think Naito's a Hall of Famer, how is Reigns not a Hall of Famer? Because
Naito individually would have a much larger impact on business than Roman Reigns. Like, as to scale, Roman Reigns maybe is theoretically a bigger star, but a lot of that is because WWE is a bigger company.
Bigger Naito star himself. Impact on business are different things.
Yes. Like, Naito, like as an individual draw, I think so Naito has a...
What are the different... What is it about being a star that is not necessarily encompassed in being... A draw, is that what we said? Is it name recognition? Is this like the Ultimate Warrior? But Ultimate Warrior, which would freak a lot of people out, right? Who are not acquainted with this Hall of Fame. That the Ultimate Warrior is not in this Hall of Fame. He's off the ballot, probably never getting in. but a very recognizable name.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Goldberg's going to go that way too?
I think Goldberg has a stronger case than Ultimate Warrior, but I doubt he's getting in this year.
Yeah,
at a minimum. But is that it? Like, is it name recognition that Roman Reigns has, like the Ultimate Warrior?
So the case
has,
for the case being so the case against Roman is that his accomplishments as a drawing card are largely attributable to being pushed as the top guy in WWE, and that functionally almost anybody could accomplish what Roman Reigns did if they were pushed to the top. I mean, that's not to say Roman Reigns isn't talented, but Like if you were to compare Roman Reigns to John Cena, the man he replaced as a star, Reigns is not as...
I'm less convinced. I was more favorable to that view a few years ago than I am today. Uh-huh. That I don't think that... Yes, there could have been... Especially maybe somebody like John Moxley, maybe Seth Rollins. There were other options on the table. But I'm less convinced of that argument today than I was in prior years based on the role that he's grown into today, you know, with grabbing the Usos and this role that he has as you know, as a tribal chief, as somebody who I think, in fairness, you could say by pure attrition has become the star. But there are inherent qualities that he has that I think make him more viable as that sort of, you know, ace of the company, if you will.
Well, it's impossible to evaluate the current landscape of WWE in a hypothetical universe where Roman Reigns was not pushed over everyone else, because everyone that exists on the roster currently, or even people that are no longer in the company, like Jon Moxley, what we know of them today is how they have existed in a world where Roman Reigns was pushed above everyone else, and everyone else was made to be reduced and to not appear to be a top star relative to Roman Reigns. So it's hard to really go back in time and say, well, if they pushed this person instead and they pushed this person instead, things would be different. It's really hard to evaluate what that would mean, because what we understand, the only facts that we have, is a world where Roman Reigns was pushed above everyone else. So it's hard to go back in time, but I do think that if they pushed somebody who wasn't directly adversarial to what a lot of fans at the time wanted to do, the company would have been more successful. You said that, Brandon.
Yes.
So what have they reached a point where they're no longer being met with such adversary from their fan base with the push of Roman Reigns? Yes. Is Roman Reigns the biggest babyface in the company and the most popular wrestler? Yes. How long, what cost did it take to get there? I think is an important question, which is one, and it's why Reigns, I think, so I'll just plug it now. On Thursday, I did a podcast with Adam Berger on the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. And the theme of the podcast was, who do we think are the most intriguing candidates on the ballot? Not necessarily people we'd vote for, but who do we find to have the most interesting cases and who has the most kind of intriguing candidacy? And the first person I picked was Roman Reigns, because I think his candidacy is very unique and very fascinating to discuss because of the ramifications of what it means to be a star in WWE in the 2010s and now into the 2020s. And we can't evaluate drawing power with contemporary stars the same way we can use drawing power as a measure and a tool for stars in the territory era, because it's much harder to evaluate that.
I guess I want to separate. And I do believe there's a cost to Vince McMahon pushing Roman Reigns in the way that he did from 2015 to 2020, mm-hmm. whatever it is. That cost was AEW. But who's to blame for that? Vince McMahon, not Roman Reigns. Roman Reigns is a talent in his own right. And I don't think that that's part of a case against him, I guess.
But if we're evaluating his drawing record, the fact that he probably was a less optimal draw than other people would have been in that situation. And the fact is that the pushing and elevation of him into main events alienated a large enough swath of the fan base to create competition and also drive viewers away from the product, I think, has to be considered as part of his candidacy.
It has to be. Why? That those are booking decisions made by Vince.
But if we're evaluating his drawing power and Reigns is only getting in, I think at the moment as a drawing power, the number one, criteria category, number one, drawing power, we can't just celebrate his successes. You also have to evaluate failures. And so you're making
his failures.
Yes. So you're making a more philosophical argument that he should, because those are poor booking decisions on the behalf of Vince McMahon, they should not be necessarily held against Roman Reigns as an individual performer.
And those booking decisions that Vince made, which were to the detriment of the company, nonetheless enhanced Reigns' ability to be a draw, even though it wasn't in the best interest of the company. I accept that as a given. But it nonetheless made him a bigger star and bigger draw, by far the biggest draw post Cena that WWE has had. So why is that held against him?
So you're saying that because, we can say that the booking practices around Roman Reigns from 2015 to 2019 or whatever date you want to pick, were negative. In the end, it turned him into a big star. So why should we be looking at that as a negative?
Right. Which I accept is a stupid situation. And I don't know if there's a comparison for that in wrestling history where somebody was chosen and was a pawn in a fight between a promoter and a fan base. Nonetheless, he did become and was talented enough to become the star and economic positive contributor that he was, despite
he's become an economic contributor compared to his peers.
Yes.
And why is that? Is it because Roman Reigns himself is great, or is it because his peers have been reduced?
I mean, if Vince had chosen some random, untalented dude from FCW.
He did.
Untalented?
I think Roman Reigns is like a B-level talent.
I think there are a lot worse choices, and I don't know that Reigns was even the wrong one. What I believe strongly, though, is the way that Vince went about it hurt the company and even hurt Reigns' ability to be an even bigger star than he's become, which is a substantial star already, but could have been a much larger and more effective star had there been rational creative around him.
I suppose. I don't think Reigns has A-level charisma. And so I think it's hard to get around that.
You think you'll vote for him eventually, though?
Yeah. Oh, yes. This is part of the
Hall
of Fame.
Despite being a B-level
This is part of the Hall of Fame. This is about checking my own individual opinions and biases against the reality, which is the fact is a lot of people think Roman Reigns is tremendous. I think a lot of people think Roman Reigns is a tremendous wrestler. And while it's
my opinion, in-ring performer by wrestling,
I think just in general, like a lot of people are going to vote for Roman Reigns this year. And I think at some point I have to get off of my island and just say, look, this guy's accomplished a lot. I don't have to putting him in the Hall of Fame is not me like saying like, you know what, Roman Reigns is great and he deserves to be in and I love him now. It's being rational about his career and the impact that he has had on wrestling and how the consensus fan base seems to feel about him. Which is why I will consider voting for him in the future. It doesn't make me a big fan of Roman Reigns. It doesn't make me change my opinion on, you know, how good I think of him as a performer is. It's weighing my own personal biases and views against a broader perspective and trying to be fair to each individual candidate. I understand that there are many, many styles of professional wrestling and there are many, many different ways to go about business. Not all of them are going to appeal to me as an individual, but as a voter, it's my responsibility to set aside those beliefs to the degree that I am capable of doing and to present and to evaluate each case candidate based on, I think, what would be their optimal candidacy and see if that passes the criteria enough to me to consider voting for them.
Yeah. So I have one more thing in that. I don't know if this is a point in support of Reigns as a candidate or not, but I think it's somewhat like, to make an analogy to maybe like football, if there was a, you know, you got a football team, and let's think to take maybe it's neater to make this not about a Hall of Fame comparison, but maybe think about a team and like in Buffalo we have the Wall of Fame, right, where they put somebody's name and number up on the ring in the stadium, and like if there was an era in the history of a team where coach general manager decided I'm going with this guy as the quarterback, even though there are, you know, even though a lot of people, critics think we should trade him away or go with a different quarterback, or maybe even we've got a second string quarterback who's better. I say, no, you're wrong. I believe in this quarterback. It's really about my ego battle with whoever is criticizing me. But anyway, and we go with this quarterback for years and years. And this quarterback, he's like the all-time team leader in yards now. Maybe all-time is too strong, but he's among the quarterbacks who have the most yards and touchdowns and he's a leader in all these stats. I think that's a similar case to what we have in Reigns, right? Again, I'm not saying that that's for or against, but that's kind of the state.
Yeah, it's hard with real sport. It's hard with real sports because statistics.
That's a perfect analogy.
Statistics in real sports are ultimately inarguable in certain ways. We can argue about context, but they're ultimately like you either did this performance against the same level of competition or you did not.
I have the cage match data. Okay. We can talk
Gallo, do you have anything to add to the
Yeah, I just wanted to like now John Cena got in 2012. Isn't this a similar situation? With Cena and Reigns, like, why the hesitance on Reigns against Cena?
I think Cena's accepted as a draw more so than Reigns is.
I see very similar, like, trajectories, but we look current day, Reigns is a really...
And I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but in this populace, in this subculture of fandom, and this is not just fans and reporters, but it's wrestlers too, Cena's accepted as a draw, as a merch seller, as whatever... He was and house shows. I can make a case and look at, you know, market to market. in those last few years, like, you know, the 2000s and 2010s, that's even when you compare the same markets, you know, house shows where he was on them versus house shows in the same market where he was not on them, that those house shows did perform better. I can't say there's that also, about Reigns. There's, like, well, there's again, also, we have a different house show system now.
And Cena also existed in an era, the last kind of era, pre-network era, where drawing power is much more easy to calculate. You can look at what the pay-per-views did year over year with him on the top versus other people. You can look at, like, even things like the huge WrestleMania matches against The Rock, like the record-setting pay-per-view business that those shows did, in a way that...
Can we not look at, like, look at all these WrestleMania main events that he was in? And
sure,
you want to chalk it up to the brand, sales, I guess. Yeah. But look, the biggest gates, the brand of all time, the four biggest gates of all time. Yes,
that's why it's absurd, right? That's why it's absurd to argue that he's eventually not going to get in, because you look at the statistics and it says that. It's a fascinating argument because we're really talking about a star of attrition versus individual star in a certain way. But yeah, I mean. Who do you think is more individually talented, Roman Reigns or John Cena? Who's more charismatic?
I think John Cena is a better promo than Reigns is, but yeah. I think Reigns has become a pretty good promo too. I think, I don't know. I will admit I've cared less and less about in-ring performances since I've stopped wrestling. But
I don't think it's that much of a difference between Cena and Reigns.
I think there's a really big gap in charisma.
Charisma, maybe, yeah, I would give you that. But in-ring performance, I don't think there's that big of a gap.
Oh, no, I think Reigns would probably be a better worker than Cena is. Now, of course, they're doing WWE main event style matches, which one could argue are not particularly engaging, but require less skill to work in. But I think, like, when I say Reigns isn't talented, like, I look at John Cena and I say, Reigns is supposed to replace John Cena, and he's... not nearly as charismatic as John Cena. He's not nearly as confident of a speaker as John Cena. If anything, Roman Reigns has become a better promo by talking less, or being better utilized by talking less. I think Cena's overwhelming ability set up a blueprint for Roman Reigns to fail at first. I think Cena's ability to go in front of an audience that might be hostile towards him and cut a long promo that the fans would eventually be engaged in and would be interested in seeing a conclusion to led WWE down a bad path with Reigns, where they assumed that they could push Reigns in the exact same way without realizing the fact that Cena himself is a unique entity.
I think it's definitely true that Cena is better in the face of a hostile crowd than Reigns is.
Cena and The Rock and CM Punk, I would say, are the three guys of the modern era that are the absolute best at giving them a microphone and cut a 10-minute promo that people will be interested in seeing. And that is the critical role as a top WWE top star. That's what they need you to do, because that's how the show had been formatted for so long. Reigns' skill set was not best suited for that, which is one of the reasons he struggled.
Which is a fairly recent development in wrestling history. It's not like Hogan ever did that.
No, it's not. It's most time you would cut like a 30-second backstage promo, but the Attitude Era and specifically The Rock and then later John Cena being so outstandingly good at that, and other people like Chris Jericho and Batista, guys who were also, you know...
Don't forget Triple H.
I didn't want to say... But Triple H, you know, I feel like Triple H promos can be good and can be bad. I don't really feel that strongly either way, but... That's kind of the way that WWE wanted them to be, and I think it kind of
chief content officer.
I think the reason I bring it up as an example is basically looking at, like, John Cena was so talented he was able to make it work. Roman Reigns wasn't as talented, so they had to find a different way to utilize him. Maybe Reigns is more talented in different ways than John Cena, but I think Reigns is like a far step down from a talent department than John Cena is. And if you look at like The Rock and Steve Austin, and Hulk Hogan, and Randy Savage, like the talent level those guys possessed versus the talent level that Roman Reigns possess is a clear step down, in my opinion. And Reigns being the face of WWE, being the biggest star in the world, that was the kind of aspirations he had to live up to.
John Cena will be selling Hondas later today when you watch the football. Does we that had a super, is stronger? Go ahead.
We had a super chat regarding the Wrestling Observer newsletter Hall of Fame. Louis Ducati asked, Johnny Saint, not on the European, New Zealand, Australia ballot, WTF.
He's on the ballot. We didn't show that on that chart, but he's on the ballot this year.
Yes, he is. He's right here. Yeah. He is on the ballot. Yeah, we'll talk about the candidacy of Joe Higuchi and others another time. Anything else to add? I know did you want to touch on the AEW ticket sales and things like that?
I just want to see what the data said, because I think the AEW is looking at some lower advances for upcoming shows and their attendance.
We want to know about advances specifically. I feel like I have no frame of reference to
fair.
Look at advances while I know there's with the Bridgeport, Connecticut advance is like under 2,000 right now for a show that's in like the middle of November, that it's hard to say that doesn't look weak compared to
well, like the Boston show, I think is at about a little under 3,000 in the advance. There's a Boston show coming up. I believe it's on the 9th. Wednesday, November 9th. I'm going to it, so I should know this. I just know it's on Wednesday. So Wednesday, November 9th, there's a Boston show. I think it's at like 3,000 advance, and those had been over 5,000 each time.
So what we have on the screen here are data from WrestleTix, tickets distributed, averages for each month. The most consistent metric to look at for AEW is Dynamite. We have averages for Dynamite for every month, and there's four or five of them in every month. This is separating them out from the events that are just Rampage or just Battle of the Belts tapings. And this month of October, which is over now, I guess, for Dynamite, is at 4,600. 4,600, which is lower than – it's not the lowest ever. I mean, there's March here of 2022. It's probably not a time when people would be decrying the downfall of AEW, where they did only 4,100 for an average. Again, doing it this month, 4,600 for an average. So even in August of 2021, they did a 4,400 average, which is a little bit lower than they did in this month. I would say, without breaking this down further into markets, which could be insightful, and I've done a little bit of that in spreadsheets, but I think this is one data point. It's just a blip or a trend. Further months will tell us. My intuition is that AEW was benefited in the past by visiting a lot of markets for the first time or for the earlier portion of their history, and that was a novelty factor that helped them. They had CM Punk in the past, who they will not have going forward, who is clearly a positive contributor in my view. And that's not present anymore. And I think we're starting to see what the normal level is for AEW in terms of being a live event business, and that's maybe around 5,000.
Do you think, in general, AEW's business has more room to fluctuate than WWE's business? And from just using live attendance as a standpoint, do you think AEW is more, less, or the same of capable of being able to produce like an angle that suddenly gets hot and sells a lot of tickets? I think it's been difficult for WWE to do that over the years, but do you think AEW is still at a point where, as a company where it's only a few years old, where maybe like it's more conceivable that something like the MJF angle could really get hot and they could start seeing their attendance jump up like by like maybe 15 or 20%, as opposed to WWE, which is more as a larger, more stable audience where it sometimes can become more difficult to kind of increase?
No, not really. I think what brings people to these buildings is kind of what I tweeted about last night. This is a nuanced thing to say between nobody's a draw, the brand is a draw, and there's truth to that, but I don't believe that outright. Stars matter. Having CM Punk matters. Turning MJF into a bigger and bigger star matters. Having John Moxley, Jericho, etc. matters. And that helps the contingent of people who are contributing to this company's ability to sell tickets. Well, that's true. I think the expected quality of show that your brand is going to put on matters a lot, too. And maybe it's something like half the story. Whereas in prior times, in the context of a moment ago, talking about the Hall of Fame, where those companies that those stars were associated with had comparatively weak brand identities. Whereas today we have very clear brand identities when it comes to WWE and AEW. That is a much bigger factor. That's not to say if MJF becomes a way, way bigger star than he is today and becomes this massive wrestling star, I would expect that to be bared out in ticket sales. But no, I don't think like a hot feud, which I almost even question to what degree that there are really great cases for that in the course of history of wrestling history, where like this hot feud, it was so hot and it's made all these tickets get sold. I don't have experience looking at data like that, but maybe that's just the lack of research that I've done.
So you're questioning all of this history that's been repeated to us, that so-and-so came into the territory and popped the territory. You're saying that may not be true. For I think what, business back then. So like,
there's a really like, obvious example of that.
So the Von Erichs, right? The Von Erichs get really big, mm-hmm. and they turn, you know, the Dallas territory into this marquee, huge territory. Or Junkyard Dog in New Orleans gets hot and suddenly they're running the Superdome. Or, you know, Dusty Rhodes taking off in Florida. Or,
well, there, all I think various that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that those sound like cases to me of stars who emerged as draws. What I'm thinking about is like so-and-so are at least somewhat stars, but their feud really popped business for a while. I'm lacking data to say.
So established stars that pop business. Is that what you're talking about?
I guess so.
So like Bruno Sammartino and Larry Zbyszko feud, right? One of the biggest drawing feuds of the time. Or Bruno Sammartino and Stan Hansen that draw 40,000 fans to Shea Stadium. I think if you go back in history, wrestling is more ubiquitous in society, and therefore wrestling is more capable of seeing wide fluctuations event to event, month to month, than in the modern era. And I'm curious to know if AEW would be more likely to see those kind of fluctuations still as a brand looking to establish itself than WWE, which is a known quantity at this point. And I think it's been a challenge for WWE wrestlers of the modern era, including Roman Reigns, to kind of have to make that a clear part of their track record, just because of the way the business is for WWE today.
And this helps WWE in that just because of it being a brand that is so well known, has such brand equity, that's why they're able to draw some of what they're able to draw in terms of sales.
Yeah, it's why they're able to draw more. And like things like WrestleMania can sell a lot of tickets before any match has been announced because the brand of WrestleMania is strong enough. But it's more of a case of WWE having a clear established core group of fans, as opposed to AEW, which I think maybe has a more fluctuating
not enough base AEW of fans. Freakazoids yet.
More, there are more casual people who will sample AEW's product on a percentage basis than maybe WWE's product on a week-to-week basis.
WWE's not capturing the casual fan.
WWE can capture the casual fan, but I think because AEW's a smaller company, that there's a wider swath of fans out there that could... Look, we know there's roughly about a million wrestling fans each week who watch WWE programming but don't watch AEW programming. So we should... AEW theoretically can capture those fans. There's not... WWE can't say necessarily the same thing because they're the biggest... They have the largest market share of fans.
I think there's...
This is getting too far down into a semantics hole. I didn't mean to plunge us this deep.
Well... Oh, I think in general there should be more of these conversations because everybody talks about these terms as if we all agree on what they mean. But like TV viewership, for example, and I guess we'll put this slide up here. That stat, which is questionable, that TBS put out there, 3.5 million. What was it, Gullo? We talked about it on Thursday. 3.5 million.
Yeah, 3.5 million
unique viewers who watched at least, is it 1 second? A minute,
1 minute.
In any case, what I want to say here is that like there's about a million people on average on a minute basis per minute who watch Dynamite. But I think what there really are, when we're talking about how many wrestling fans are there, at least when it comes to even traditional TV consumption, it's a lot more than a million people who are watching AEW. On an average minute-by-minute basis, it's a million. But when it comes to the number of people who watch, like, let's say, at least 15 minutes of it, it's a lot more than a million. And so it's a lot more than 2 million or whatever it is for Raw and SmackDown.
We have a couple of super chats regarding this, if you don't mind, while we're on this topic here. Tim B, do you think there is an overall business seasonality involved with both companies? Like, WWE appears to fail each summer and AEW each fall and early winter.
Oh, I don't know that it's different for the companies, but I would say in general, Q4 and Q1 definitely do better for WWE, and that's why it's important to do year-over-year comparisons for ticket sales, for TV ratings, certainly in the case of Raw, where it's going against Monday Night Football. I don't know. I mean, with AEW, we're going to be looking at this Q3 in 2021 for a long time as a high watermark, I think. But I don't know that there's different seasonality for AEW. I doubt it.
AEW hasn't been around long enough to really establish a clear track record of seasonality. We've only been through like two or three seasons of AEW in total, as opposed to WWE. I think it's been decades for us to identify like the lead up to WrestleMania as being a high point and the Monday Night Football season being a low point.
There's just broader trends in terms of winter months, people watch television more, more entertainment more.
Yeah.
Summer months, people watch television less. I can see that in the Showbiz Daily data, and people go to indoor entertainment less, which is just a headwind and conversely a tailwind. That's not to say that you can't do good business in those times.
Super chat here from Big Time Baxter. Do you have a chart that shows Dynamite's 18 to 49 and P50 plus? It looks like there's been an 18% drop in 18 to 49 and an 18% increase with over 50 since moving to TBS.
What do we want here? A chart that shows. Okay. What we want then is since moving to TBS, I can do like a year over year thing here. So let's share. Let's share the big spreadsheet. And I think I have a tab kind of ready to address that, unless I cleared that all out with the P50 plus. I did. So here's P18 and 49. TBS is January 5th, 2022 and forward. I will now on the air generate a pivot table for P50 plus. This is the kind of content you will only get here on WrestleNomics Radio. That's why if you do not listen to this program or watch it on YouTube, you are utterly lost and your takes don't matter.
Which, by the way, at the end of the year, we should probably do that in an episode. Look at the move to TBS over a year of data, ratings data, and how it compared to TNT, and was it a success?
Is that not what we're doing right now?
Well, we're doing a little bit, but I mean at the end of the year, like literally a full year.
Okay. What I see here, so this is the average P50 plus rating, which is very similar to the number of viewers. 0.37 in 2021, an entire year on TNT. 0.40 in 2022. Half of that 2021, well, like 3.5 months of it were in the Wednesday Night War. So that's certainly dragging this rating down. It's up 7%. In 18 to 49, 18 to 49 is essentially flat. We could look deeper into the quarters, but it's essentially flat. What else? You're muted.
While we were on AEW business trends, I figured I'd bring those two super chats up. There we have one more super chat, which we could bring when we wrap up here in a few minutes, because it goes back to your guys, Wrestling Observer, Hall of Fame conversation. So,
okay. Do you have anything else? All I have left, I think, is Jeopardy. But we can save Jeopardy for next week because we're already at an hour and a half, unless you really want to do it.
So yeah, we can save it.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's all I got.
All right. So yeah, we'll do the super chat then here. That goes back to your guys' conversation on the Hall of Fame. This is from CWJ128. Wouldn't the better comparison be Reigns and Moxley? I would guess without blinking an eye, you would put Moxley in. Thank you.
Moxley's not on the ballot this year.
Yeah,
I don't think.
Better than what was the is this in reference to the comparison we were making between Reigns and Naito?
Probably Reigns and Cena, probably both of those.
The comparison that Brandon was making between Reigns and Naito, I'm not comparing the two.
Would I put Moxley in without blinking an eye? I don't know. I do not.
No, definitely not without blinking an eye. Moxley has things like, if you value like the Wrestler of the Year award, like I think every wrestler to everyone Wrestler of the Year is in, except for another person.
Except for Moxley Mystico.
Has won that.
Except for
Mystico is the one guy. Mystico might get in this year.
Yes, I voted for him in the past.
I don't vote in Mexico, so
I know. I did last year, and I probably will continue to vote for him.
Good. There needs to be more, as the chart you showed. There's kind of been a decline in Mexico voters, so probably more people should be getting involved.
And I voted for Sangre Chicana too.
But. Moxley, Moxley has a Wrestler of the Year award, so people value that. That might Moxley, put him in.
Did he win Wrestler of the Year last year?
No, he won it in 2020.
2020. Okay, I think he's right. Definitely going to win it this year. I think there's at least a really strong case for him to win it.
I think, yeah, Reigns might win it this year. I would say Moxley, given the Observer's readership.
Not going to win it from the Observer readers.
Yeah. But Reigns has finished, close. I think he finished second before, so it's not like it's impossible. But I think Moxley might win a second one, which, if you value that, some voters might not care about that at all, but it shows kind of like a level of success. I mean, as an individual star, Reigns is a bigger star than Jon Moxley. As individual drawing cards, I don't know. I don't know if Moxley's proven to be a really big individual drawing card. I think he's a star. I think some people may favor Moxley as an overall performer over Roman Reigns. But Moxley's not like a likely candidate to get in at the moment. He was on the ballot last year. He failed to get the, 15% that you need to get to stay on the ballot each year? Or is it 10% of the vote? So he's
10. Yeah.
Yeah, so he really was nowhere close to getting in. I think Reigns, who also failed a few years ago but is back on this year, I think Reigns is definitely going to get at least a minimum to get on. So I think the voters now would assume that Reigns is a much better candidate than Moxley. Personally, I'd probably lean towards Moxley, but I wouldn't vote. I don't think I'd vote for either at the moment.
It's another age thing, I guess. Like if I were comfortable with the age thing, then I would probably vote Moxley, and maybe I would vote Reigns in too. Hulk Hogan has never won the Wrestler of the Year award in the Observer. Cena did.
Correct. Ric Flair was. It's the Flair Fez Award. It's named after Ric Flair. It's not the Hulk Hogan Award.
The dozen or so voters who were voting for Wrestler of the Year probably in the 1980s. All of them.
Yes, I think the voting now is a much more, I think, egalitarian process than it would have been back in the 80s.
I think there's just like, this is
like, did John Cena ever win it? I have no idea.
Yes, twice. He won it in 2007 and 2010.
Yeah.
And this could send us down another hour of conversation. I think there's an Observer frame of viewing the business that may have been more relevant in the 80s and 90s that I'm questioning how relevant it is, or at least how sufficient it is for encompassing an understanding of the economic forces that determine the wrestling business. By that, I mean the way that fans think about wrestling, even younger fans and older fans too, I guess, is not the way that Observer reading fans think about the business. And it's has not been the case that as people have gotten more access to the internet, everyone has adopted that as like the orthodoxy. Maybe that's one of the denominations, but there's another one that doesn't consider match quality in the same way, if at all, and that just thinks about wrestling differently and makes choices about consumption on a different frame of reference. Anyway, that's a much larger conversation.
We have another super chat here. Big Time Baxter asks, "Has NXT viewership, improved since Vince retired?" Yes, it has. 100%.
Yes, it has. Yes. Let's. We can give you a quick. I have a tab in my spreadsheet completely dedicated to that consideration. In fact, the viewership in the same number of days that Vince has been gone compared to the same to compare that number of days. It's been 100 days. It's been 100 days since Vince has been gone. And in that time, NXT is up 14% in total viewership, 15% in the demo, 24% in 18 to 34. NXT year over year in October was actually up in the demo and in total viewership this year, or this October versus last year October, which is the first time that there has been a positive comparison in a year over year comparison of a month in more than a year. NXT has definitely improved in viewership. So credit to Paul Levesque for changing the business. And his underling Shawn Michaels.
I think if you were a fan of NXT kind of before NXT 2.0, Triple H being back in power would be seen as a huge positive and something you'd want to see. I find the NXT product like unwatchably bad, but so I don't think it's really improved. But I think that the aspirations for fans to want it to see it be better is
716,000 viewers every week disagree.
Speaking of Paul Levesque, I wanted to get your guys' thoughts on the news that I woke up to this morning that Nakamura is going to wrestle in Noah on January 1st against Kaiji Muto. That's pretty huge, and I don't see that happening if Vince was still in charge.
Well, Kenta worked a match. I'm going to try to find it right now.
With Mario Fuji. Is that Kenta or is that Hideo Itami?
Kenta worked a match. He worked as Hideo Itami for Marufuji's 20th anniversary show back in 2018. Okay. So there is a precedent to be done here. I have heard speculation that it would be Muto for their Hall of Fame
when
this year.
Kenta / Hideo Itami did that in whatever year that was. Was Vince even aware that he did that?
Well, he was also on the NXT roster too, right? So it's like...
He wasn't on the main roster.
Yeah, Nakamura is a main roster talent, a guy that's held, you know, championships and... been a fixture on television.
Yeah. I believe Itami was on the main roster when he did that because he was in 2018.
What did Kenta ever do on the main roster? Was he just on 205 Live or was he on
anything? Yeah, he was on 205 Live a lot. So was Vince aware that he was on the main roster?
Did he remember for more than a day that was approved of?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that. The speculation I've seen, which is just fan speculation, means nothing, but it would make some sense, is that Muto may be going into the WWE Hall of Fame this year. And that might be...
They do like to do a Japanese candidate every year.
Yeah, and Muto would make sense. Who is more famous to American fans than Keiji Muto? Maybe they'll get some tape of him or something.
What were you
like
calling
that.
Him? You have an alternate. I think he has a different name in Gullah World. What is his name?
The Great Muta?
No. You said something else
before. Oh, I mispronounced the name because I
the
said
great,
it
the Great
bad.
Kanji Muto.
So this is what I want to kind of bring this up. So if you guys remember when Brody Lee was left WWE and he was being interviewed and everything, he brought the fact that one of the bargaining chips was Paul Levesque goes, well, we can let you go work in Japan if you want to go work in Japan. And I think we talked about this, Brandon. We didn't think that would ever be a possibility if Brody resigned and all that.
That was something that he said, Triple H said. Yep.
Is this – could this be a reality? Could be when negotiations come up for guys? Could Paul Levesque, now that he's in charge, be like, yeah, you want to go work Japan? Want to go to Mexico? Sure.
I think that's something he might tell people. Yep.
I feel like Carl Anderson – we can talk to Carl Anderson all about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, remember Del Rio did like a
Triple Carl Anderson's going to appear to defend that title. So.
Did Del Rio do a Triple A match? Like he had to drop a Triple A title, the Mega.
Yeah, that's happened before.
But when it's when they just resign, it's different. But when you're in the middle of a contract or you know,
I think Triple H and WWE will continue to be very protective of their wrestling world, and I don't think that they. They may do certain things to accommodate people, and they may not be as hostile as and dismissive as Vince was, but I don't think they're going to, like, open the forbidden door and do all these great interpromotional things.
Well, there was also discussion, remember, potentially, like, working with New Japan specifically for Bryan Danielson to, like, work in New Japan as a bargaining chip to get him to re-sign with WWE. Yes.
Supposedly Nick Khan talked to New Japan, and Tony Khan has discussed this. Saying you know, that Rock, that is I think this is part of the Ariel Helwani interview, right? That like Rocky Romero had said that he had talked to them, but they're not doing anything. And yeah, I think they are probably, WWE is probably more interested in a bargaining chip for talent and maybe for excluding opportunities for AEW than they are capitalizing on those opportunities themselves.
Hmm. I mean, they did the Mickie James Rumble thing was really interesting, but we haven't seen anything after that with Impact at all. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Any plugs?
Yes. My podcast, the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, which I've already basically plugged it today, but if people want to find it, it's on YouTube, Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast. I was joined by Adam Berger, who has done a lot of research into the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame, and we went over our personal five favorite intriguing candidates. We talked about a lot about Roman Reigns on it. We talked about Edge. We talked about Bill Goldberg. We talked about the Von Erichs. We talked about Ishii. So people are in, like the Hall of Fame discussions. They can find it over at the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast because we did a very lengthy podcast about it on Thursday.
Yeah, for me, I will actually got a few appearances this weekend. You can check out. I'll Friday night in the Buffalo area, I'll be doing stand-up comedy at Roll Hall's Corner, part of a big showcase. A lot of really good Buffalo comics on that show. And then Saturday, I'll be at Excite Wrestling, and we got Davey Richards versus Kevin Bennett. Alec Price will be there, and a few others. So it's a pretty stacked card. So you could see me this weekend either doing comedy or bringing out some wrestling.
Mm-hmm. There's the Patreon, patreon.com/WrestleNomics. You can get TV ratings reports nearly every day. The quarter hours when available. Been reporting those for WNAW shows, slides to this podcast, and a lot more. And I will be, where's the slide? I will be in attendance for the post-wrestling 5-year anniversary show, which is on November 19th, the same day as Full Gear at QXT's nightclub just down the street from the Prudential Center. Free fist bumps if you want them. No pressure, though. But they will be available as part of your admission if you want them. That's all for this week. Talk to you on Thursday. We'll do the Thursday 30 with Gullo and I, and that'll be just for subscribers. So you have to be a subscriber at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. Talk to you then. Bye.